Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008. Brooke Spector, editor at the Daily Maverick Association. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Good morning. There's an echo there. Okay, it's gone now.
All right. I was just going to say we can hear you very clearly. So that's
okay. So that's for a second there, suddenly I heard myself four times.
It's always disconcerting. That. Absolutely.
Yeah. Shouldn't need that. No, Colin Powell was a path setter and precedent setter and a glass ceiling breaker in a whole range of different ways. Let me take your first point. He wasn't, and I will dispel the myth a bit, he wasn't fluent in Yiddish, but he had picked up a fair amount of it working as a child and as a teenager in various local businesses in a community which, as you say, was very much a mixed community. One thing I did learn that I didn't know, that for a while, for a small Orthodox shul in his neighborhood, he was a Shabbos goy. I bet you didn't know that.
I did not know that. That is just unbelievable. So for all of our listeners who don't know what a Shabbos goy is, I'm always uncomfortable with the word goy. I don't know. I've debated this. I don't know whether it's offensive or not. But either way, the term Shabbos goy is, you know, on the Sabbath, Orthodox Jews, Shabbat observant Jews are not allowed to do things like switch on a light or an air conditioning, etc. But if there's a non-Jewish person around and they are prepared to do that for you, that's great. So that's obviously, he played that role because of the neighborhood in which he lived, presumably.
He apparently earned 75 cents a week, which at that time, as you know, the currency being what it is, that was not nothing. And he worked in a baby store. They didn't sell babies, obviously. They sold baby clothes and appliances carriages and what have you. And he didn't go to West Point, like many military officers who have led, the army, have. He went to City University of New York City, which is well known as a hothouse for, academia in New York City, and the whole clutch of people who were called public intellectuals in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, many of them came from there. But he studied geology, and he admits he was a particularly indifferent student, getting a C average, which would have been what in local terms sort of mid 60s as a university grade. But he found his calling when he signed up to ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps, Cadet Corps. And that, if you stayed the course and went all the way through it, then that helped pay your expenses. You graduated as a second lieutenant, and then you joined the regular army, which he did, and found himself challenged but rising fast. This was an American army. He joined in 1962, I think, and the army had only been desegregated for 12 years.
Incredible.
And so there were still many holdovers from the earlier segregated army, and it was not seen as the norm yet for a young black officer to be telling white enlisted men what to do and where to go and how to do it. And he ended up serving two tours in Vietnam and various other ranks, and he was quickly moving forward. He became the youngest chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's the highest position in the military. And he became National Security Advisor under Ronald Reagan, and he was, as I say, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then eventually Secretary of State. And this is where he came most importantly to global notice, And we have to say it, this was his, although there were many good parts of that career, there was one, as we know, not so salubrious element in it.
And what happened at that point? Because there was this hope that he was going to go the distance, and then it just didn't happen.
Well, a couple of things happened. He was prevailed upon by the people in George W. Bush's administration, for whom he was the Secretary of State, to give that speech at the United Nations. I'm sure you remember it. The one where he held up the little vial of the pseudo-anthrax disease crystals and narrated that video with presumed to demonstrate that the Iraqis were well on the path to developing nuclear weapons and other forms of mass destruction. And he reluctantly but ultimately bought into the idea that he would have to make this pitch to the world that this was the reason the U.S. was going to go to war against Iraq in 2003. He had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the first war, the Persian Gulf War, but that was a very different one. There were some 45 nations who joined together. This was to liberate Kuwait from Iraq, and his military philosophy was famously encapsulated in the General, how are you going to deal with the Iraqi army? First, we're going to cut it off, and then we're going to kill it, was his mantra.
Right,
and
right.
That is pretty much what happened.
Right.
In 2003, however, he gave himself over to the lie, and he explained that there was, in fact, a great possibility of those weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist, and it was the leading argument for the U.S. government to lead its attack on Iraq, capture, and ultimately the downfall of the Saddam Hussein regime. Having said all that, there was still the feeling among Republicans, certainly, and among many Democrats, that he could run for president on either party and win. And that would have been very similar to the circumstances of another general, Dwight Eisenhower, back in 1952, whose political affiliations were sufficiently obscure or opaque that it seemed perfectly reasonable for him to be the candidate for either party. And in Colin Powell's case, his personal narrative and life story, his rise through the military, and his sheer presence, I guess you'd have to call it, his ability to project that aura. Now, I didn't know him. I met him in Tokyo twice when he was serving there, and he came through once as a government official and once as a speaker for a Japanese newspaper. And in a crowd of, I don't know, 500 or 600 people, he had everybody absolutely spellbound, hanging on to every word, through the interpreting, which is quite a trick, to hear him explain his concept of leadership. That was a big thing for him, that you lead by example as well as simply by ordering people around. You have to lead them because they want to follow you, and that was his mantra. And finally, of course, now he had retired, in his 80s, he was suffering from Parkinson's disease. He was suffering from a particular form of cancer, myeloma, blood disease, I believe it is. And he'd gotten his vaccinations as somebody should. But the virus got him anyway. Mm-hmm. And so there we are. Passed away yesterday at the age of 84.
As much as he achieved in his life, and the story of his life is phenomenal, considering, and I think it's very, very difficult for us to look back and really understand what he must have dealt with in terms of racial prejudice, in terms of everything that he had to fight for. Even given all of that, is there still an element on, after his passing, of unfulfilled potential?
It's an interesting question. in an interview somewhere along the way, he said that his life's ambition had been to become Secretary of State. You know, the usual story is that America is a country where any boy can become, can rise to become president. Well, you know, maybe so, and maybe every girl can someday as well. But Colin Powell obviously had his eyes set on the position of Secretary of State. And it is, it has been reported that the break on further ambition to moving to being a candidate for president was in fact his wife, who feared that by virtue of his racial identity and by virtue of the high stakes effort that would have been, his life might have been at risk by somebody, you know, some mad person with a weapon. Because you don't automatically have Secret Service protection simply because you say, I'm going to be president. Absolutely. And you get it, right, you know, once you're a full-fledged candidate. Mm. And so Alma, his wife, who had been with him for 50-some years, which is also quite a mark of achievement, apparently was thoroughly convinced that some terrible thing might happen to him. And so as a result, I guess he settled for his own personal achievement and forswore what others might have wanted for him,
right,
and thereby had his highest success and also the thing which unfortunately people will also remember him by. One other thing we should mention then before we go is that his life trajectory,
right,
in that racially and religiously and ethnically mixed neighborhood, Hunts Point in the Bronx, he was one of the community of Jamaican Americans, immigrants from Jamaica. His parents had moved to the United States before he was born, certainly. Otherwise, talk about becoming president would not have been possible. And immigrant children tend typically to be high achievers. They try, they want
right,
to. You,
right.
You immigrate somewhere because you want to become better.
Absolutely.
Than where you were before. And,
incredible.
His story concludes, I guess, with while he was working in that baby carriage and children's clothing store, the owners of it, called him over when he was in his teens. And said, Colin, you're really nice, you're a bright kid, but I have my own family to support, so I can't give you part of this business. You're bright, go to university. And that set him on his path.